Welcome back, Dan Maudsley here with you till 5. After 2, the gadget detective, Fevzy, will be back taking your calls and answering your tech quandaries. 0500 909 693 with any questions for Fevzy. Text 85058 or at BBC5Live on social media. Welcome back to 5 Live Up All Night, and it is time now for our tech phone. And Fevzy Turkalp from GadgetDetective.com here to help. If you've got any technology problems, you can contact us, assuming you can get your gadget to work, of course, by calling 0500 909 693. You can text 85058, or you can get in touch on social media at BBC5Live. You can even email, if you want, upallnight at bbc.co.uk. First, though, let's introduce the gadget detective himself, Fevzy. How are you doing?
Morning, Dan. Yes, good, thank you.
And what's going on in your technological world this week?
Well, we've got lots of stories. We've got a gadget feature on SSD drives and why it's probably a good time now to finally give your older computer a midlife kick by putting in one of these solid-state drives. But also some interesting stories. Amazon launched a competitor to YouTube this week, which I think a lot of people don't really realise how important a step that is, because Amazon is one of the few companies that can give Google a run for its money. Google, on the other hand, has been improving its Google Translator, making it more Star Trek-like as we speak. An AI program called IBM Watson is now helping children at Alder Hey Hospital in Liverpool.
Good stuff. All right, well, Fevzy, we may well get on to a few of those later on, because we've already got a first call in. Steve is on the line. And Steve, you're having trouble with your tablet.
Well, hi Dan, hi Fabzi.
Hello, Steve.
I've had the tablet about a year and a half, and I've heard with interest, mainly on your show, about things like malware and viruses and so on, but it's more been sort of just academic interest. However, yesterday I was attacked for the first time. I've looked into it, and I think it might be what they call a police ransom trojan. It threatened to wipe all data. It locked the browser. It said that I had 24 hours to pay £100 by what they called pay safe card voucher. As I say, it was completely locked. I could, however, get into Google. I could get into Google Play and sort of other parts. It was just the browser. Weirdly enough, the second time I switched the Wi-Fi off and went into Google, put in some random thing, switched it on, it then went into the browser and it had all cleared up. Now, I knew from the start that it was gobbledygook, because they referred to UK law, and there is no such thing as UK law. They also mentioned articles such and such and articles such and such, which ranged everything from breach of copyright to children's pornography to bestiality and so on. But there are no such codified articles in English law anyway. So it was a load of nonsense. But I was looking into Google Play and a few other things in a pretty cursory manner, and there just seems to be that many apps for viruses, in addition to which I'm not sure, although it has pretty inexplicably gone away, I'm not sure if there's still somewhere in the machine a lurking virus.
Sure. Okay. And Steve, can I just tell you, I had a very similar experience with a supposed FBI notice myself a few days ago. Cost me a few hours of my time to make sure that it was harmless. So this can be a range of things. So this is where a message flashes up on the screen. Sometimes it, as you say, takes over the browser itself, tells you that it's a message from the FBI, you've been a bad boy, and why not fork over some money, which doesn't really ring true, really. I mean, the FBI may be many things, it's not short of money. For the most part, these represent websites that have themselves become infected. And unfortunately, there are many ways in which perfectly legitimate websites can get infected. And one of the most common ways is through the advertising that they carry, because adverts are no longer these sort of static pictures or text. They involve a language running in the background known as a script to make it an active thing. So and unfortunately, it's possible to actually load viruses which are into ads which are nothing directly to do with the website. A lot of websites just suck up adverts into spaces that they provide for them, but don't have any direct control over them. So quite often it is when a website itself becomes infected. Now, when a website is infected and you visit that website, it is possible for that infection to pass on to the device that you're using to browse, and that's a kind of hit and run type infection that can occur. The fact that you're on a browser, that you're on a tablet, I beg your pardon, was it an Android tablet or?
Yes, it was. Yeah, and that's the other slight thing, because some of these apps appear to be for one thing and not the other. Some are for Android, some just appear to be for phones.
Yeah. And although there are, quite a number now of pieces of malware that run on Android tablets, there are far more that are targeted towards Windows for, just reasons of numbers of users. So it's relatively unlikely that you will have actually been infected. The fact that it managed to, temporarily mess up your browser doesn't mean in and of itself that you were infected. However, I would say we are now in a stage where it is actually worthwhile running internet security software on your tablet and on your smartphone. And I hate to say this, because it was nice for so long that we could do without it, but I think we're on the cusp of the point where we should now be doing that. So there are various products that you can consider. Symantec do a version of Norton which does have that facility, and they do quite a nice bundle in that you can buy one that it allows you to install it on Windows, Mac OS X for Apple Macintoshes, Android, and even iOS for Apple devices. With that, you can install it under a single license across the board, but there are other very good packages. Kaspersky do one for mobile devices, as does ESET, ESET. Those are all good. There are other good ones out there. I've used these ones and found them to be solid.
So what about things like CleanMaster, Stubborn, Trojan Killer, Avast, those sorts of ones that are on Google Play?
The ones that I mentioned to you are the ones that I've used, and that's not to say the others are no good. They may be good. I think if you want to venture further afield from the ones that I've suggested to you, I would look very carefully, as with anything on the Google Play Store, or in fact any App Store, look at how long it's been up there. Okay, don't download something that's new, and look for a long and positive history of reviews. Yeah, going back a long way, and in that way, you can reduce the odds of you making the problem worse by downloading an incorrect piece of software. So, but if you, my opinion is, if you stick to the big names and get them through, you can get them through the App Store. You can load them on in other ways as well. I think it's a safer bet. And once you've got something like that on there, I would do full system scan of your system. In addition to that, I would, going forward, I would make sure that you have a full backup of the things on your tablet. So just as you back up your PC or your desktop or your laptop computer, we're at the point where it's worth backing up your tablet, because it can have photos, it can have music, it can have all sorts of records on there. And of course, evidence of you logging onto shopping sites and banking websites and so forth, and that sort of evidence can be grabbed, that information can be grabbed to your detriment. But I think the fact that you've got control of it back is to your credit. The other type of infection that we're seeing increasingly now is something called ransomware, which is where an infection gets on your system. It doesn't announce itself straight away. And what it does in the background is it encrypts all of your files. That's to say, it scrambles them all with a secret key which only they hold. Until it's finished scrambling every file on usable file on the system, and then it says, "Oh, by the way, here I am. This is what I've done," and it will cost you a Bitcoin, which is, you know, a few hundred dollars, more than a few hundred dollars, in fact, to unlock it. And you know, people do get caught in that way.
Now, I have children who do that to my entire life constantly.
Yeah, but that's kind of self-inflicted in a
they're
way.
They're not demanding money yet, but I suspect it's all part of a grand.
It's only when they demand it with menaces. But ransomware is a big problem, and if you look at the statistics for not only the amount of ransomware infections that are out there, but the amount of money that these people are netting, it's rising pretty much exponentially. You know, quarter on quarter now, because it's big money. There have been cases even of, you know, police precincts in America being found to have been paying ransoms. And, you know, it's the same problem as any ransom situation. You pay the ransom because you want something back. But in doing so,
encourage them.
Yeah, you make it much more
well,
likely.
Steve, I hope we've helped you. Suggestions on the tweets, I'm not sure this actually applies. Well, it doesn't in this situation, but it's good advice anyway. Recommend you use Microsoft Restore Facility to go back to a previous date. This is real sociable dad before the virus, and run a virus scan, which would be good advice for Windows, but this was an Android tablet, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, certainly it would be. But the best protection against ransomware, in addition to all your normal sort of antivirus, anti-spyware stuff, your best protection is regular backups, or either onto the cloud where
yeah, I was going to say, with a tablet, quite often it's automatic now. All your pictures are saved to Google Photos or Apple Photos, or, you know, depending on which service you're using.
Yeah, the worry is that these programs are getting smarter, and it won't be long before they're reaching into cloud services. The other thing that you can do, including with tablets, although it's not as easy, is back up onto an external drive and then disconnect the drive, keep it in a separate location. So that backup will protect you, because then even if they do scramble all your files, you can just reinstate them. Yes.
Okay, well, on portable drives, we've may have a pertinent call in that case. This is Nasib in Bradford. You essentially want to be able to password protect an external drive.
Yeah, that's right. Hi, Dan, and hi, Fevzy. Yeah, so in my case, I've got several USB flash drives over 6, 7, 8 years old, and I've got a portable hard drive, a mega hard drive, 250 gigabyte hard drive, and I want to password protect, because many times I've left the flash drive in a computer, in a library, etc., wherever, and, you know, I've had to go back and get it, but fortunately no one's taken it, so I need to password protect. And I went on the internet and I read something about you can download some software, but however, is it the case that it's better to buy new kit where the password protection already built onto the USB flash drive and hard drive? So that's essentially the question.
It is better, yeah. So you can password protect any sort of USB drive, and, you know, you can use for example, there's something built into Windows called BitLocker, and you can use that, or you can use third-party tools to password protect, you know, any data on any type of USB drive. However, as you've correctly alluded to, there are drives that are designed and built with security in mind, and they have hardware encryption, which is not only gives you a performance advantage in terms of encrypting and decrypting on the fly, so that you know, it can remain in encrypted form as stored, but you can access it transparently as if it was unencrypted. It gives you that benefit, but it also gives you the benefit of being able to hardware secure all or sections of the drive, and even make sections of the drive disappear to the operating system as well. Because one of the best ways of affecting security is obfuscation, to actually make it appear that there's no data there to break open. So yes, I would say so. And the major manufacturers, all the major manufacturers of USB thumb drives, do have hardware protected versions. Some of them, by the way, have biometrics built into them. They'll have, for example, fingerprint readers. Others will have a small keypad built into it, where you have to actually enter a physical code. So it's a second tier of protection. And I'd say, if you've got something that's particularly sensitive, I would go for one of those types of drives. Having said that, they do cost a lot more, because most people don't go for them, and therefore, you know, economies of scale being what they are, you know, you could pay 4 or 5 times as much for the same capacity because of these extra features. But compared potentially to the value of the data that they're protecting, then it's good value.
Well, I hope that's helped you, Nassim. On external hard drives, Roy, my heart goes out to you in Edmonton. My external hard drive has crashed, losing all data. How do I recover my photos and music files? What are the basic steps in this situation, Fevzi?
Okay. Well, my commiserations, because it's happened to most of us at some time or another, and you know, your heart sinks when you start to work out everything that's on there that you may have potentially lost. So this can happen for a number of reasons. Some of those reasons mean that the data is still there and is easily recoverable. Others may mean you need professional services, and other faults may mean that the data is actually lost in part or in whole. How you proceed depends upon the value of the data to you. There are certain tools that you can get and try to use yourself to recover from a broken file. For example, there's a program called Get Data Back, which you can search for online and find it. There's a free version of that which doesn't actually recover your data, but will scan the drive and tell you whether it will be successful in getting the data back, then invites you to pay for it. They are a legitimate program, and therefore that might be one option for you. If the data was priceless, your nearly complete novel, or photos of a deceased loved one, or something that just can't be replaced, then you've also got the option of taking the drive to a company that will do a professional recovery job on it. That will give you the best chance of recovery, but it's also very expensive. That service starts in the hundreds of pounds and goes up depending on how complex. They can, for example, take a drive, take off the damaged circuit board, find an identical circuit board, reattach it to the drive and reinvigorate it that way. There are many things that can be done. It depends whether it's the electronics around the drive that's gone, or there's damage to the actual, drive surfaces themselves. So, it is tricky. It does obviously highlight the necessity and the wisdom in doing backups, but one can't be smug about this. I think we've all been caught, myself included, of not having always the best possible level of backups. But I would say that there's also a program called Spinrite, which is Spinrite, one word. Spinrite makes the claim of being able to get data back pretty much of any drive that's still capable of spinning. It's produced by a guy who's very well known and well respected in the field, called Steve Gibson. I would suggest to you that Spinrite might be a good way to go. Spinrite's one of those things that you set it running on your drive. It can take hours, days, or even weeks to complete, depending on the size of drive.
Yeah, if it's that important, though, that you'll wait that long.
It's a good thing to do. But the thing that I'd say to you about all of this, and this is a decision you have to make at the beginning, is how vital is that data? What's it worth to you? Because the more you play around with third-party apps yourself, the more likely you are to further damage the drive and make the data less recoverable. Mm. But obviously, you do it yourself, it's cheap or free. You give it to a company, it'll cost you hundreds of pounds plus. So that's a decision that you sort of have to make first. But there are various ways around. For example, if the electronics have failed, it's an external USB drive, you can crack open the drive, you can remove the drive from the electronics that make it a USB drive, so that it will just have what's called a SATA interface, which is the sort of built-in native interface of the hard drive.
Okay.
And then you can get a SATA to USB connector and just copy it over that way, if the problem's with the USB. So part of the issue is diagnosing the problem.
All right. Well, we're getting texts on dealing with spam, texts on the pros and cons of integrated smartphone batteries. We'll get onto some of those in a bit. There's one here I can deal with. Martin in Manchester recently bought a secondhand Sony Alpha 200. I've had that camera. It takes a compact flash memory card. Can you explain the difference between compact flash and SD? It's size, really, isn't it? I mean, they're physically bigger, and photographers used to like them, I think, for that reason, because you couldn't lose them as easily. But everyone's switching to SD now. But that's an older camera. It'll take compact flash. They're still pretty easy to get hold of as well.
Actually, a lot of the pro digital SLRs will still use compact flash because it is bigger. Therefore, it's still possible, no matter how advanced, you know, memory integration is, it's still possible to get bigger capacities into a compact flash card because it's physically bigger. You can fit, you know, half a dozen SD cards into a compact flash card in terms of volume.
That's the long and short of it, really, isn't it? It's just a physically different size of card. But
also you can get at their fastest, they can outperform the best of the SD cards. Although, frankly, with the fastest cards, the bottleneck tends to be the camera.
And certainly,
with the Sony Alpha 200, I'm familiar with that one because I actually had the Sony Alpha 100, which was Sony's first digital SLR. Great cameras, by the way. You can do that. And by the way, you can get adapters that allow you to plug SD cards into compact flash caddies and then plug them into the slot.
All right, Martin, if you've got a large collection of SD cards, there's your answer.
Yeah, because they're cheaper for the capacity because people buy them. You get economies of scale. So it's often worth just plugging an SD card into slot. In the same way as, you know, you can make a slot from micro SD card to go into an SD adapter, you can adapt all the way up to compact flash size.
Good stuff. I want to get a call in before the news. This is Eva in London, and Eva, you've downloaded Windows 10, and it worked beautifully for 3 weeks. What happened next?
Tuesday this week, the computer doesn't respond to any of my clicks. So I phoned four agents from Microsoft. And each one was telling me different story. One of them said that I need to pay £99 to get the proper version of Windows. He didn't install, so when I found another agent, he said he ordered so it will be shipped to my doors. I'm quite concerned because he was the first agent who was doing remotely on my computer. He asked to put the details of my credit card, including the three security numbers, and I just worry that if my card was compromised, and he was going through my emails, so if my password was compromised as well.
Well, Eva, you are absolutely right to be worried, and I have to say that what you've described to me bears all the hallmarks of you having been scammed.
I was listening to that.
But it always was the same numbers, Microsoft number. So the next agent actually was doing remotely, talking to Microsoft, the woman called herself Ginger, that I will get the money back, okay? And I don't know what else can I do.
Dan, I'm concerned that Eva's potentially in quite a lot of trouble here. I hate to say this, and I wonder if we can hold her over after 5:30 because this is very rife, and I think there's some remedial advice that I need to give,
let's start now. Exactly that. We'll take the news in a couple of minutes, but as I mentioned, we have quite a few texts, and this is quite a common one actually. Now, the phones are, in fact, the smarter you get, the more likely this is. Integrated batteries, as in ones you can't take out and change if they go wrong. This is Christina in Coatbridge asking this. What do you think of them? What are the pros and what are the cons?
Okay, so the cons of an integrated battery are unfortunately many. They are this, that when the battery has a certain life, and I don't mean the number of hours it survives on the charge, but the number of times that you can recharge it. Typically, it's a few hundred times before you start noticing that the maximum capacity of the battery is diminishing, month by month, until the point where it will hold no charge at all. When that happens, when it's no longer performing as well as you need it to, you can't just get another battery and pop it in yourself. It's not a user-serviceable part. You have to send it back through your dealer or to the manufacturer and get them to do it. They will invariably charge you more because you have to use one of their batteries and their service to do it. The second disadvantage is that smartphones often struggle to get through a whole day on a single charge, so people often having to carry around external batteries and so forth. The neater solution is, if you've got a phone that has a replaceable battery, is you buy a second battery, you charge it up, and you take that out with you, and as the first battery runs down, off comes the back, out pops the first battery, in pops the second one, and you're good to go for you know, probably the better part of another 24 hours. Then when you get home, you just charge them both up. Obviously, if you've got something like an iPhone or one of the many other smartphones that have sealed battery units, that's not an option for you. You have to either buy an external battery case or an external USB battery, which you then charge up, which will work, but is ungainly. The benefits are that it's possible to have a sleeker design, a more robust design, because you don't have a removable back. But in my opinion, a well-designed phone with a removable battery can still be sleek and robust. That would be always be my preference. But unfortunately, the fashion, and it is to do with fashion as well and styling, is often now to have integrated batteries.
Okay, well, that's taken us neatly up to 2:30.
On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. This is BBC Five Live.
On DAB digital radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio Five Live. Up all night.
Dan Maudsley here. We're back with the gadget detective, Fevzi Turkup. So let us know if he can help you. Call 0500 909 693, text 85058. Email upallnight@bbc.co.uk, or you can get in touch on social media at BBC5Live. And Fevzi, before the news, we were talking to Eva, and you're quite worried about what she was telling you.
Yeah, Eva, thanks for holding on. Just before the news, I think you were explaining that you'd had some problems with your computer, that you'd spoken to what you believe to be Microsoft representatives one after the other, and you'd allowed them remote access to your computer. So various alarm bells have gone off in my mind. All of these are classic indicators of scams and frauds that unfortunately are all too commonly perpetrated on, you know, unsuspecting computer users. Eva, can I just ask you a question? Where did you get the number from that you rang that you believe to be Microsoft?
From Norton, because I'm using Norton for many, many years, uh-huh. And they've given me the number.
Well, when you say Norton, are you using the Norton Search Facility, which is a part of
No, them? Norton Security.
Yeah, and so there is a facility to do safe search within Norton. Look, I think, Eva, what you've told me is sufficiently alarming that I think we have to assume that you've been scammed. And, you know, if I'm wrong, then, you know, I'm sorry, but I'd be fairly confident that you probably weren't speaking to Microsoft and that Microsoft aren't in the habit of reaching into your machine remotely in order to help you. Microsoft have got many, many millions of customers, and it's not a service that they provide, and they certainly don't start asking for credit card details and the rest of it. So if we assume that these people are up to no good, what we need to do now is damage limitation. So the first thing is, do you ever do online banking, or do you ever do online shopping using a credit card or any other type of bank card?
Yes.
Right. So what you need to do is contact your bank.
I did. That's okay. I done straight away.
You've done that. Well done. Well, you're off to a very good start. And have you informed them that you suspect that you've been scammed and that someone may have access to your bank account?
Okay. Yes, but they cannot help me because I volunteer giving this number, giving my credit card number. So the only my question is,
I'm sorry, did you say they can't help you?
No, they said because I volunteer my number to the agent.
Okay.
Presumably, right. Microsoft agent.
Eva, let's take one step backwards. When contacting your bank and credit card company and other people that I'm going to advise you to speak to, one of the important things is being very careful where you get their number from. So, for example, if you have a credit card, on the back of your credit card, there will be a phone number, which normally it's labelled as being, for theft or loss of the card. But the benefit of that number is it's a 24-hour number, 7 days a week. And you can...
The number you rang, straight away.
Okay, on the back of your card.
That's right, yes.
Okay, so there
are... I got the letter, actually, yesterday as well, that normally they would refund, but because I volunteer with my closed card details, they cannot help me.
And have they indicated to you how much money has been taken?
No, it's only £99.
Right, okay.
And when I spoke to the other agent, you see, all those agents are giving you their own number. So the other agent was doing... I saw on my computer, actually they can see all my emails. They can somehow get through. I cannot. Whatever click I make, the computer doesn't respond.
Yeah, they've locked you out. Look... Okay, let me just take a few steps back, and I'll give this advice to you, but I'll also try and couch it in general terms that other people in a similar situation can follow. Mm-hmm. So one has to assume that they've got access to your accounts and that the damage may not be limited to the £99 that you knowingly paid them. £99 is not nice to lose, but it's much less than could be at risk in a situation like this. Mm-hmm. So there are two issues with this. If they want to argue about, you know, whether you've been negligent, that's up to them. You can have that discussion with them later. But the important thing is to put your bank and your credit card companies on notice that your accounts have in all likelihood been compromised, and for them to put blocks on those cards and those accounts.
Okay.
So that's the most important thing. And in doing that, you must be very, very careful that you are speaking to the organizations that you believe you are. So you take the numbers from the bills that you've previously received or the back of the card. You do not go online. You do not allow anyone to email you the information. You know, you find it independently. Even you walk into a branch and you ask them for the number that will deal with this. So that's the first thing. The next thing is you need to check your credit report. Everyone has credit reports compiled on them by companies such as Experian. And that's a good indication, because if they've got enough of your information, enough of your credentials, they can start to do what's called identity theft, where they pretend to be you and typically take out loans in your name. Mm-hmm. So you need to see if that's happening, because your bank won't necessarily be aware of that, because they could take out a loan with any other bank or any number of other types of organizations. So you need to check your credit report. The next thing
is... How do I do it?
Okay. There's two companies that I can name to you. One is called Experian, E-X-P-E-R.
Excuse me, what's the number? What's the name?
The name is Experian.
Experian.
And the other big company that does this is called Equifax. Mm-hmm. Okay. They charge, I think, about £2 for a report, you know, for the initial trial report. And it's a good idea to do that. You can get someone who's got a safe computer to look that up for you. You can try directory inquiries. If you've got a safe computer, you can try and get it from there. The next step, and I'm sorry to rush through this, but there's quite a lot that you need to do, so I'm going to try and crack on if you don't mind. The next step is to register with an organisation called CIFAS. That's C-I-F for Freddie.
Sorry, Bessie, can you speak up, because
I'm so sorry. C for Charlie, I for India, F for Foxtrot, A for Alpha, S for Sierra. CIFAS. Uh-huh. And they're an organisation that will put a flag against your name on something called the National Fraud Database. So companies will carry out extra checks before they approve applications for financial products in your name, including a loan. So membership costs £20 a year. And it does mean that when you go to make a legitimate application, it will take longer, because they're going to do extra checks. But they're going to check that the person who claims to be you, who's trying to take out loans or other financial products in your name, is who they say they are. It's £20 well spent under these circumstances.
And that lasts for a year, Fevzi. It's not you're not going to have trouble taking out a loan for the rest of...
I need the name again. C for Charlie.
I for India. F for Foxtrot. A for Alpha. S for Sierra. And again, a safe internet connection on another machine, not the one that you've had compromised.
Yes, okay.
And then on Monday, when they open at 9 o'clock in the morning, I would speak to an organization called Action Fraud.
Okay.
Action Fraud are available via the internet, but also their phone number I can give you here is 0300
123
2040. That's 0300 123 2040. Now, Action Fraud, first of all, will take a report of fraud, so they'll gather it for statistical purposes. That doesn't in and of itself help you. Mm-hmm. But what they will also do is they will talk you through what I've told you in more detail, and they will add some suggestions to what I've told you as well. Okay? These are the essential steps that you need to take. So make sure you identify all your credit cards. Now, one last thing, and it's very important. You said you thought they had got into your email, and if they've got remote access to your machine, there's every possibility that they may have got into your email account. Okay, so it's very important that you immediately try and see if you have still got access to your email account. So, and the way that you do that is you try and log into your email account using your existing password. If it will let you in, the first thing you must do is change your email password. Mm-hmm. And the reason why this is important, Eva, because you say, well, that's not a financial transaction, it's not so important. Your email is the key to the kingdom, as it were, because every website that you may ever have registered with, you know, where you give them a username and you choose a password, you know, invariably these websites have a button that say, have you forgotten the password? If so, click here. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, if you click there, they or one of these miscreants who appears to have scammed you, if you click or they click on that link, it will send them an email with a password reset. So they could then reset the passwords on your online banking, your credit card, anything that you've ever registered for on a website. So it's very important to see if you can lock them out by changing it. Ideally, you will do this on a safe machine, because we don't know if they've put an infection on your machine that would, for example, log every key press on your keyboard. So you need to get some help with this. Get someone who's got access to a machine that's believed to be clean and try and change the password from there. If you're locked out, then you need to speak to whichever company provides your email address and ask them to restore access to the email account back to you.
Okay, Eva. I hope we've helped you there and pointed in the direction of some more advice as well. Hopefully, we'll be able to get to the bottom of what's gone on and not be hit any further. Some advice from Stuart. Another credit agency, which is free and advertised on TV, is clearscore.com. I think they use one of the ones you mentioned, don't they? And it's
There is a free one that gets recommended by Action Fraud, and to be frank, I can't remember the name of it now, but if Eva speaks to Action Fraud on Monday, they will certainly give that information. But the urgent stuff is it's all urgent, but I would say the email account, the bank accounts and the credit cards would be my first port of call.
Okay, perhaps a pertinent question given our last discussion. This is Ashok in Birmingham. How do you tell a legitimate notice that you need to update software or an app on your PC or Android phone?
It's a very good question, Ashok, and increasingly difficult to tell. So, for example, if you're a Windows user, there are settings inside Windows that basically say to you, you can tell it that you want to update Windows manually, or you allow it to automatically download but not install, or you allow it to download and install. The best setting for that, unfortunately, in these days is to allow them to download and install. So as far as patching Windows is concerned, you can set it up so that it happens automatically, and then you have to not worry about Windows or take any further steps. Similarly, Microsoft products, such as the Office products, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, those sorts of things, can also be set to update automatically. Beyond that, it is a bit tricky. What I would say is, if a third party offers you an update to your existing software, rather than click the link in the pop-up that offers it to you, and certainly don't be clicking any links inside emails either, but rather than do that, you could go to the website itself, check the current version and see if it's later than the version you have installed. Now, that is, you know, that's a pain. But for example, a lot of computers still have got Adobe Flash installed upon them, which is used to provide animation on the screen inside websites and elsewhere. So if a pop-up comes up on your screen that claims to be, you know, an update for Adobe Flash, it could be illegitimate, it may not be, you've really no way of knowing. The safe thing to do is go to the Adobe UK website and download it from there. You, by the way, you don't really even in that case have to check what the version numbers are. You can just download the correct one, and if you've already got the current version, it will tell you, and it will abort the process. But that would be the way to do it. I would not try not to rely upon the links that pop up on screens, because it's very, very difficult to tell now.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left, so if you want to get your text or question in, or you want to give Fevzi a call, now is the time to do it. 0500 909 693. Text 85058. We've got someone on the line right now, which is John in Brighton, and you're trying to reinstall Windows 7, John.
Yes. Yeah, my laptop stopped booting, and so I wanted to reinstall Windows 7, and I think I'm getting a message that says the disk is protected, or the hard disk is protected.
Well, the hard disk should not be write protected. You've got an original Windows 7 disk, yes?
Yes.
And is it, John, is it the disk that came with that particular machine?
No, I think it's just that, yeah, it's just another disk I've got, yeah.
Okay. There are many different types of Windows 7 disks. There are the sort of generic retail ones that, you know, what they call the retail disk, as opposed to an OEM disk. The retail disk can be installed on any machine. The OEM disk may or may not be able to be installed. And then there are things that manufacturers provide, which isn't a sort of a generic version of Windows that can be reinstalled or installed onto any new machine. It's specifically designed just as a mirror image of the hard disk as it was when that machine was new, with all the drivers and so forth that apply to that particular machine. So you need to kind of work out what you've got. What does it say on the disk itself?
I think it is an OEM. It's just a standard Windows 7 SP1 disk.
Right, so it's quite old as well.
But I think it's just a standard, you know, disk. Yeah. Mm.
And what's happened to the Windows installation you've got at the moment? Is it completely inoperable, or?
Well, it just doesn't boot up. It doesn't boot into Windows, basically.
Okay.
I tried to sort of use the disk to reinstall, and I seem to be getting a message quite very, you know, right at the beginning, not far into booting off the DVD, the disk is write protected, or the media is write protected, or I can't remember exactly what it says.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're trying to write to install to something that is not a writable drive, and that should not happen with a hard drive. It's not,
yeah.
You know, it's not common for hard drives to be marked as write protected for obvious reasons. I would do this, John, and it's a bit hard to diagnose it without seeing it, but I would say try and do what's called a safe mode boot into Windows. So first of all, pop that disk into the DVD or CD drive on your computer when the computer switched off. Then switch it on. But as soon as you switch it on, I don't know if you know how to do this, but you tap the F8 key every 1 or 2 seconds repeatedly from the moment you switch it on to the moment you get what's called a safe mode menu come up, which is a black screen with white writing on it. And then from there, you can navigate to options to do a repair of your existing installation. The benefit of doing a repair of Windows is that, at least in theory, it should allow your data, not the Windows operating system, but, you know, your photos and your music and your documents, to remain without being wiped out. If you do a fresh install, it will wipe out anything that's, you know, of yours on there. And if you haven't got backups, that's a problem. So try and navigate from the Windows safe mode menu into what's called a repair, and see if it will allow you to do that. I do have some concerns that if this disk didn't come with that particular machine, and if it's not a generic retail one, you may have two issues. One is it may not work, and two, the license may not apply, in which case, in strict terms, it wouldn't be a legal copy. Let's deal with the technical bit first. So give that a go, see if you can do a repair. If you can't, then you can either, you know, phone back on this show in a couple of weeks, or try and reach me through Twitter.
Are you saying to do a repair, to boot off the disc, the DVD disc that I've got, and do a repair?
To try and boot off the hard drive sufficient to do a to see if it will allow you in to do a safe mode boot off the installation that you already have.
So boot off the computer as it is now into safe mode,
If you can. All right. That would be my advice. If not, come back for further advice.
Okay, John, I hope that's helped you out. Let's squeeze in a few more texts. We may be able to get in another call, 0500 909 693, if you want to give Fevzy a ring. This is Graham in Nottingham's texted. I'm getting loads of spam emails, 60 to 80 a day. But there's no domain name, only loads of numbers separated by equal signs. How can I block or stop them? I use Microsoft Outlook. I don't, he just doesn't know how to get rid of them.
Yeah, so you need a spam filter. So either you will buy one and run it on your computer locally, i.e. on the machine itself, or you use one of the services like Gmail to clean up. So if you've got a Gmail email account, it's got a spam filter that's extremely effective. And in fact, what some people do, a little sort of trick of the trade, is even if the email address that you use isn't a Gmail address, what you can do is set up your own email to forward through the Gmail address and then access it through that. So you're using Gmail as a free filter. So you can do that, or you can run a spam filter. The Norton one, Symantec's Norton spam filter, is very effective. And what happens is, it doesn't matter if it appears to come from a sort of gobbledygook address. All you need to do is mark it as spam. It will know most of them already, but you train it. So if it makes a mistake and labels something as spam that isn't, you correct it. Equally, if it misses a spam, you tell it that spam. And within a very short period of time, it will be sort of 99.9% accurate. And you can always look through the spam folder to make sure it hasn't, you know, misfiled something for you. That's a very good solution. A neater solution is to let your email company do it. The only problem with that is if they block something as spam and they're wrong, you won't know because you will never see it.
Always that issue. Helen in the West Midlands, she has an HP laptop. She's trying to connect her iPhone to iTunes. It's not recognising it. Is there anything you could help me with? is there something obvious that she might be missing?
Well, no. I mean, the standard advice to that would be make sure you're running the latest version of iTunes, and in updating it, make sure, therefore, that it's not become corrupted if necessary. Uninstall and reinstall it. Equally, make sure that you're running the latest version of iOS that your iPhone is capable of running. If it's not recognizing it, it's also possible that it could be the cable that you're using to connect the two. So try a different cable. If that doesn't work, try it on a different computer, and then by a process of deduction, we can see where the problem lies.
There's lots of ways effectively now not to have to use iTunes.
No, that's right. And in fact, for things like podcasting, I saw some data recently, and whereas it was over 90% of all podcasts were listened to via iTunes, I think that's down to about 70% now. There are lots, and particularly for, you know, smartphones and tablets, there's a great program, for example, on iOS called Overcast, which is a great way of, subscribing to podcasts and downloading and so on.
And effectively, a lot of the things that people used iTunes for in the past with their phone, either to back up or to put music on their phone or transfer the pictures off. These are all things that can be done in the cloud now or just on your phone.
There can be. I mean, I think that there are real benefits to having backups locally as well as or instead of in the cloud. But certainly you can do a lot of this stuff in the cloud. But, you know, to be honest, cloud services are not always bug-free either. You know, Apple make some great hardware, but they never really seem to have got their head around their cloud services completely, in my opinion. You know, that's something they still need to improve upon. And as for iTunes itself, you know, it really is in need of a major rewrite. I mean, it's highly functional, but not very easy to use.
Okay, very quickly, Michael Nisbet, what's the temporary email ad service you recommended to allow you to detect sources of spam?
Do you know what? I'm going to look at that again, because the one that I recommended is no longer taking new customers. It's now working. But next show, I will come back with some suggestions for that, because they're a bit scarce on the ground, hence the question, I think.
Right, looking forward to it. Thanks very much for all your calls and texts, and thanks very much to Fevzi for taking us through. Coming up before four, we'll be finding out why women may be able to come.